Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you very much for joining me once again as we continue our digging around in the big old monster box, and we do it just one more time. Yes, it has taken us, 6 months, almost to the day, a little over 6 months since we started this podcast, twice a week via Audioboom and iTunes, to get to the end of the Monster Box, going year by year, set by set, starting with 81 Fleer, and finishing today with 93 Tops, one of my favorite card sets, not only from the 1993 editions, but also just one of my favorite card sets from this era. And 1993 was really the last year that I went crazy with new cards. And it's funny where we've finish off our look at the big old monster box with the classic 93 top set, but with a random pull of a player who even in 1993 you really didn't think would end up being a Hall of Fame player. And it's hard to believe that when you say that now, because, well, it seems like a given, right? I mean, this guy's always been in the Hall of Fame, right? No, that's not the case. Pedro Martinez. And if you're too young to remember, in 1993, Pedro Martinez was not the Martinez card that you wanted. You wanted Ramon Martinez. Ramon, his brother, who had a very successful career, especially in the early 90s, and was part of the LA Dodgers organization for much of his career. And by 1993, Ramon Martinez was really racking up the wins, really starting to make a name for himself, making the Dodgers look good, taking him out of their Dominican camp, signing him as a free agent back in 1984. In fact, 1993 would be a nice little bounce back year for Ramon Martinez after a 20-win season in 1990. But no, it was Pedro underneath the radar, or off the radar, I should say, under the surface, if you will. And he had a good 1993 season, but not good enough for the Dodgers to keep him around, thus setting up perhaps the worst trade in Dodgers history. Although I will make an argument, much like I did for the Mets and Nolan Ryan back in 1971, the Dodgers weren't actually too far off their rocker when they traded Pedro Martinez to the Montreal Expos for Delino DeShields in 1994. I know you hear those names and you go, wait, what? Pedro for Delino DeShields? How is that not the worst trade? Well, it's still up there. A trade made actually in 1993, November of 93. But we'll talk about that. And the 93 top set, which is still extremely popular today, is one of the few base sets from the junk wax era that still has a lot of fans and a lot of love and attention thrown to it for a few reasons. One of them, no bigger than card number 98, which is graced by Derek Jeter, or as they say in the Bronx, Derek Jeter. All right, let's see what you're saying at Wax and Gum Stains. That is our Twitter feed. We've got some interesting conversations going on this week, and I've picked three here that kind of cover the gamut of everything. And Wax and Gum Stains, again, if you're just joining us and you're catching up on podcasts, make sure you share the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed with your friends, those who collect now or who collected back then, because it's just everything that's going on in the world of the hobby of baseball cards is all right here. Sometimes we have people talking about our podcast. We have people talking about our random pulls. And then we have some random conversations, to say the least, going on here. But it's always good stuff. And we'll start off with a funny little note here from Christian Anderson, who a few days ago proudly exclaims, "I did it. Started listening to Wax Ecstatic after the Beckett radio appearance. Started at episode 1 and have now caught up." My goodness. Christian, I don't know if I should give you an award or sign you up for therapy, because that is a whole lot of binging going on right there. Let me see if I remember correctly. My appearance on Beckett Radio was, I think it was, when was it? January 19th. So we're just a little over a month later. So you've been averaging 2 podcasts a day. Good for you. Beckett Radio actually chimes into the conversation and suggests that we should give you a prize. And I wish I had a prize here. So for now, Christian, I will give you my endless thanks for putting yourself through all that. And I see you're actually jockeying with the Beckett Media people for a prize. And not to sell the Beckett Media people short, but yeah, that's the way to go because they probably have far better stuff than I have. I think I have a couple of, who am I kidding? Not a couple, a lot of common cards from a couple of 91 Donruss Series 1 packs. If you'd like them, please send a self-addressed stamped envelope. They'll be on your way. Also, a lot of conversation. I mentioned this in our last podcast. Our friend WaxPack916 up in Buffalo, New York, balmy Buffalo, New York, up until a few days ago, talked about how he went out and bought a box of 92 Fleer Ultra, as I had suggested in our podcast on 92 Fleer Ultra a few weeks back. And we've got a lot of funny comments about it, including The Walking Dead Saga, who writes, to quote the late Ronnie Van Zant, ooh, that smell. Those packs had that unforgettable aroma to them, aroma in all caps. Now, I've mentioned on this podcast plenty of times before the intoxicating aroma of the old wax pack baseball cards. And we're talking 91 tops and prior, specifically tops. And to be honest, really 1990 tops, because in 91 they started wrapping the cards in cellophane. But again, if you're a collector, a longtime collector, or you have bought old tops baseball cards from the 1980s or prior, if you haven't done this, just do it. But get an old pack of cards, and you know what? Even save yourself some money. Just buy an 88 tops, just dirt cheap. You can probably find them for, depending where you get them, probably less than a dollar for a pack. And open up the pack and just stick the cards right up to your nose, because they're 88 tops. They're not going to be worth that much. And just go, and you will be taken aback by the bizarre, yet bizarrely appropriate smell of cardboard stock, wax wrappers, and rotten, rock-solid chewing gum. It's a great smell, and it's one that I absolutely love, and especially since, you know, you just opened a nearly 30-year-old pack of baseball cards. Even if you decided to hang on to those cards, you could, months from now, pick up that same stack of cards and do the same thing. Just put them right up to your nose and go, and you will hit that same high that all of us collectors had back in the day of cardboard and wax and bubblegum. Now, what The Walking Dead Saga is talking about here, though, is a completely different intoxicating smell. And it might actually be toxic, so I never really enjoyed it as much. But, especially with Fleer Ultra, and you could say the same for Top Stadium Club and even Upper Deck, because they were doing the whole UV coating galore back then. But especially Fleer Ultra, you had the very unique smell of UV coating, the glossy, very high-quality cardboard stock, and the foil wrapper it came in. Now it's a completely different aroma, so I would not recommend that you open up one of those packs and jam the cards up your nose and take a big whiff, because it's, I'm not crazy about it. I'm just not. It's a little, it'll make you dizzy if you surround yourself by it too much, but you can definitely see the difference between the two. But yeah, there was a very unique aroma to Fleer Ultra and certainly a lot of the other UV coated cards from back then. Finally, something we've been talking about a lot throughout the past few podcasts, the Rediscover Topps efforts through the 2017 Topps Series 1 cards, and I would imagine this will continue into Series 2 as well. But that is the practice of the Topps company. They're taking some vintage cards, and they are stamping them with rediscovered tops, and they're stamping them in different colors so that there are some variations, and one color is a little more rare than the other color. And Josh Olson has sent us a picture. It looks like he went through a box opening here because he's got several cards. But he says, never thought I could be so happy pulling a 1989 Dave Winfield All-Star from a pack of 2017 tops. And there it is, the 89 tops Dave Winfield All-Star. And this is certainly on the downside of Winfield's career. But as we mentioned in our 92 Leaf podcast a while back, you know, Dave Winfield still had some miles in those tires, would win a World Series with Toronto in 92, and would continue to play, eventually playing for his hometown Minnesota Twins a couple years after that. But I think that's one of the fun things about the Rediscover Tops, is that what would normally be a very common card, and let's be honest, an 89 Tops Dave Winfield All-Star will probably fetch you 8 cents on the open market, maybe 9 cents on the black market, depending on what shady characters you're dealing with when you're trading 89 Topps All-Star Dave Winfield cards. But, you know, it not only gives them a little value, like I said, depending on the type of stamp they have on it, some colors are worth more or less than others. It's just kind of neat knowing that not only am I going to get some really good cards of really good players today and also the other inserts that you would expect from the base set, but there's a little bit of that anxiety. I don't know. I don't know if that's the right word for it. But you get a little excited. Hey, maybe I can pull a vintage card here. And let me remind you what my two vintage cards have been. 88 Topps Jim Dwyer, pinch hitter extraordinaire. And 86 Topps Don Robinson, who had certainly had a pretty lengthy career at that point in time, and was still looking pretty boss in his gold Pirates top with the old pillbox hat. Now, each of those cards will fetch you probably about 5 cents on the open market, 3 cents on the black market, because even those working underground aren't stupid enough to buy those cards from the common base sets from back in the 1980s. But it's kind of neat seeing those old cards. It's kind of neat seeing what color of a stamp you have on it. And it's a really fun addition to a very nice set. I've said before, 2017 Topps Series 1, I've really liked it. And I know we're a Junk Wax podcast here, and we'll get to the Junk Wax cards in a moment. But I like the set, and I have to say, if you're somebody who likes vintage cards, and you've gotten this far in the podcast, so I think you do, then it wouldn't hurt to go out. I think the odds are 1 in 6 packs. You've got the Rediscover Tops. You know, buy a couple jumbo packs or buy, you know, 8-10 retail packs or buy a box, you know, whatever makes you happy. And just see what you get. Even if it is the most common of common cards, just that little stamp, it's kind of a special feeling. You're like, wow, I got an insert. Instead of, wow, I got an 88 Topps Jim Dwyer just dropped into the middle of this pack here. So it's a neat thing, and I commend the Topps people at finally finding the right way to repurpose a lot of these common cards. Because as I've mentioned before, I kind of got back into the contemporary card collecting back in 2006. And Topps was doing essentially the same thing with rack packs, where you would go to a Walmart or a Target and find the rack packs. And in each of the cells of the rack packs, there was a vintage card. And, you know, much like the 91 Topps vintage cards inserts, they weren't really anything to get excited about. You know, you'd rip through, the pack here and go, oh, wow, look at this. I've got an 86 Topps Rich Dower. Yay. And that was basically how they suckered you into the cards. Well, now with the stamping of them and there's a little bit of a scarcity between the stamped cards, there's a little value to it. It creates a little bit of buzz, and I think it's kind of a neat thing there. So that's just part of what is going on. Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed. And again, please pass along the word about Wax and Gum Stains to all of your collecting friends. And don't forget to remind them that Wax Ecstatic comes your way twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays via Audio Boom, and iTunes. And Wax Ecstatic will be changing just a little bit moving forward. Again, this is the final set of the Big Old Monster Box, 93 Tops. We'll talk about that set and card number 557, Pedro Martinez, in just a moment. But after this, we're going to do some special podcasts by listener request. We are going to do a podcast on minor league cards. We'll do a podcast on team sets, team-issued sets, often promotional giveaways at a day at the ballpark. And then we'll do one that is actually, I think, going to be pretty fun, and that is the no logo set. And, you know, that's actually something I've said before. I've never been crazy about the no logo, you know, non-official baseball cards, not official in the sense of, you know, the Players Association didn't give its blessing. So, you know, you would have a picture of Don Mattingly and all he'd be wearing is a, you know, pinstripe suit, basically, because they had to airbrush out the Yankee logo on it. I never cared for those. But just off the top of my head, I haven't had a chance to actually look through my collection, but just off the top of my head, I know I've got some pretty bizarre cards, including the Purina Dog Chow. I've got to find that one with Will Clark and his dog. And I know I've got some from Post Cereals. I want to say I have some from Ziploc. This is just how stupid baseball cards got in the early 90s. I'm surprised X-Lax didn't release baseball cards. Here's the George Brett 1980 hemorrhoid card. Wow, look at that. So that's going to be pretty fun. So that'll be the next three podcast. And then we are going way back in time, starting with the early part of my collection. We go from the Big Old Monster Box to the Big Old Binder. And I've got one card from 1954, so we'll go back to 54 Tops. And then we've got to skip ahead to 57 Tops. And then basically from there, 57 through 1980, we'll do what we've done so far. We'll do a random pull. I'll talk about the card. And we've got some really incredible sets from the mid-1950s to 1980. Some forgettable in terms of design, although not necessarily in terms of product. And of course, a lot of great players that have come along from that time, a lot of great memories too, hopefully will be sparked. And some great stories, even though we've had a lot of great players in the last 2 to 3 years of cards that I've been looking at here. Basically, 91, 92, 93, I kept star cards and big rookie cards from those years. Some of the more interesting stories will come from the lesser-known players or the less-heralded players. Because I'll be honest with you, I don't have a 59 Tops Mickey Mantle laying around. I don't have a 64 Tops Hank Aaron laying around. I don't have a 69 Tops Willie Mays. If I did, I wouldn't be asking for money trying to find a sponsor for a podcast about baseball cards. I'd be doing far more entertaining things with my life. But I think you're going to have some fun looking back at some of these cards and maybe some of the players and perhaps a team or two that have gone by the wayside. I can tell you there are some Seattle Pilots and Washington Senator cards that are in the Big Old Binder, without a doubt. All right, let's take a look at the 93 top set, which was a classic then and is now and has actually held up its value pretty good over the years. 93 Tops was a unique set for many reasons. One is Tops broke the mold with the 792 card set, which is something that they had produced since the mid to late 70s. They've been working with that number. Well, in 1993, they went to 825 cards. Now, part of this is because you had the new Florida Marlins and Colorado Rockies, so you had to expand the set by at least 40 or 50 cards to get some kind of representation for those teams in there. But also you had some different inserts and some pretty interesting cards that were added to the base set. Now, because the set was so lofty, but also because the times were changing and card companies could do different things with different series of cards, 93 Tops was broken up into two series. It was the first time since 1973 that Topps broke a setup in a series. And in fact, sidebar here, 1974, the first year that Topps released the entire set altogether, included one of the biggest gaffes in baseball card history. No fault to the Topps people because, well, they decided way ahead of time to produce one set, one series, and put it all out at the same time. But also because the San Diego Padres were dragging their feet finding a new owner. Major League Baseball was quite literally hours away from moving the Padres to Washington, D.C., giving the district their third attempt at keeping a Major League Baseball team there. And there's actually a very famous picture now of Dave Friesenbahn, a player for the Padres, wearing a mock Washington uniform. Now, it was a road uniform, and it just said Washington. Nobody's really sure what the name of the team would have been, although if you look at the hat, there's a pretty noticeable star on there. So it might have been like the Washington Stars or something like that. But, you know, the San Diego Padres were very close to moving to Washington, D.C. Well, that's when Ray Kroc, founder of the McDonald's hamburger chain, swoops in, saves the Padres, keeps them from relocating. Well, the problem is he did that just a few weeks before the season started and a few weeks after Topps had produced the set and started shipping them out. So you have the legendary error and correction cards from 1974, the error cards with the Padres players where instead of the two color bars that had the city and the name of the team on it, for example, like the Expos, it would say Montreal at the top of the picture, and at the bottom you had a little flag kind of coming around the corner, and it would say Expos. Well, the Padres players, the upper bar said Washington, and then the bottom bar said NAT apostrophe L League. So even Topps couldn't find a way to cram the words National League onto the bottom bar. They had to abbreviate it, which looks kind of silly. Well, they really had egg in their face once the sale to Ray Kroc was approved, because now they have tens of thousands of these sets with the Washington National League on it. So they go back and correct it. So the corrected version says San Diego up top and Padres on the bottom. But that was the last time that Topps went from multiple series into one series for one set. Well, 1993, they go back to that. And like I said, the card companies were able to do some neat little tricks. You know, you'd roll out Series 1, and it wasn't just Topps, it was other companies at the time. Series 1 would be pretty basic. You know, there's a wow factor to, hey, there's new cards coming out. And people would buy the set or the series just for that. Well, then when Series 2 came out, you, of course, could have updated cards if there was a player who was traded right at the beginning of the season or late in the off season. Then you could include him if there was a big rookie that was impressing people in spring training. You could include him in the second series. And, of course, insert cards. You see a lot of the premium insert cards from a lot of the sets at this time came in a second or third series. So that way you kept driving product out the door in July and August when, you know, the wow factor, the buzz of Series 1 had clearly worn out. So Topps going back to the multiple series route here, and they put together a really nice card in 1993. And let's take a look at the random pull. Again, card number 557, Pedro Martinez. Now, even though Topps was not going the way of their premium brand, and this was a way that Topps Stadium Club had paved back in 1991 by going borderless, the way that the design worked in 1993, even though there was a lot of white border space here, it was really a well-done design because the pictures still stood out and didn't get swallowed up by the borders. And I think part of that is the design at the bottom of the card where there was really not much of a design. You have two of these diagonal bars coming out from the sides, and the color of the bars, I don't want to say corresponded with the team, but it kind of complemented the team. For example, Pedro here playing for the Dodgers, and he has this dark blue, but it's almost a purplish diagonal bar that's going across here. So, like I said, close but not exactly coordinating with the team colors, but they often complemented them. So you had these color bars coming down diagonally in the lower left and right-hand corners. You had a color bar going across connecting these diagonal bars with the player's name, and then right beneath that, a little bit of that border space kind of would creep up into the picture with the team name, and that was it. And that was it. You had the Topps logo in the upper right-hand corner, but that was it. So even though there is a little bit of a contemporary look of 1993, and this was very much a 1993 technology and typeface and all that stuff, and colors as well. Like I said, there's a little bit of a funkiness to the colors. It is still very simple. It's very clean. And because Topps had really gone out of their way to upgrade their photography over the previous few years. And of course, by the early 90s, you're starting to get more digital photography coming in. The pictures were always crisp, whether it was an action shot, like here we have Martinez in the windup about to deliver a pitch, or if it was a stage shot. And especially a lot of the expansion teams cards, you just had staged photos. That was it. Trevor Hoffman's card, he was with the Florida Marlins back then, it was just him in a studio. Jeff Conine, he was with the Marlins. I remember it was just a picture outdoors at some very South Florida-looking building. The Colorado Rockies, they had a lot of pictures taken in the Arizona desert, you know, where they were spring training. So you would have, name your Rockies player here standing in front of a cactus. So, not exactly exciting stuff, but, Topps found a good way to make even just the staged shots look a little more impressive than what you saw in past years. So a very, very basic yet really nice front to the 93 Topps cards. Now, if you flip the card over, a very unique design that did everything that past Topps cards did, but still modernized it. First of all, I believe, and I'm racking my brain here, but I believe for the first time since 1973, Topps went with a predominantly vertical presentation on the backs of their cards. Ever since the, or no, do you want, not 1973, 1975. So if I remember correctly, 73, they were vertical. 74, they were horizontal. 75, they went back to vertical. And then 76, they went back to the horizontal presentation, with the exception of a manager's card or a team leader's checklist, stuff like that. But for the average everyday player, you had the vertical presentation of stats, of information, and the player's photograph. Now, this is not the first time that Topps used photographs on the back of cards. They used the photographs of stadiums on the backs of 1992 Topps, but for the first time since 1971, this was Topps using the photograph of the player on the back. And this was a full-color photograph, 71 Topps. It was a black and white photograph. So you have the card number in the upper left-hand corner on this little yellow squiggle up top. You also have the player's name and position kind of on this crooked pennant. You have his picture, and it could be an action shot or a pose shot, but it's a picture. It wasn't as big as like Upper Deck or Fleer or what anybody else was putting on the back of cards back then, but it stood out because they did this nice little 3D shadow effect to it. To the right of the picture, you've got the player's personal information, and this is all draped on what looks like drapes, actually. This is part of the contemporary look. This has a 1993 SimCity look to it a little bit. And then beneath the picture and the personal information, you get to the complete major and minor league record, right beneath the much larger Topps logo. And you have what I've always liked, the complete history of the player's pro career. And if time and space permitted, you had the little notes that were added to the bottom. And here you have an interesting note. Pedro was signed as a free agent for Dodgers on June 18th, 1988 by Ralph Avila and Elvio Jimenez. His big league debut was on September 24th, 1992. Now we'll get to that in a moment, because that's the interesting beginning to what was an otherwise innocuous career start. for Pedro Martinez. And of course, you know, he got into the Hall of Fame eventually. But again, in the early 90s, nobody really thought that Pedro would amount to much of anything because everybody had their attention on his brother, Ramon Martinez. But anyways, getting back to 93 Tops here, it is a little bit of a dated look on the back. But again, with the photography, with the full stats, with the different display of information going with the vertical approach as opposed to the horizontal approach. And even though the backgrounds are kind of funny looking, you've got some pretty interesting color combinations here. It still magically works. So when you look at the 93 Tops set as a whole, is this something that is it one of the greatest sets of all time? No. Is it as sharp as Top Stadium Club or Fleer Ultra or certainly Upper Deck back in 1993? No. I mean, let's be honest. It was a much better card than what they had put out a few years before. Was it a premium style card? No, I wouldn't go that far. However, as the hobby was changing, as the card collectors' desires were changing, Tops had to change too. And I think, especially in 1993, you saw who didn't want to stay in the race. You saw Score starting to fall back. And again, that was mostly because Score's parent company, Pinnacle, was focusing more on Pinnacle and the Pinnacle Select brands. Same thing with Fleer. You know, Fleer, the base set was starting to drift back. And that is, again, because, you know, the Fleer company was focusing on the Ultra brand. And down the line, eventually, Donruss would start going the way of the Dodo, although I do think they had a very nice set in 1994. But again, their parent company, Leaf, was looking more towards the premium product, and that would be Leaf Studio. That would be the Leaf brand, and they would just kind of like Donruss go bye-bye over time. So when you look at the base sets from 1993, there was still an emphasis on quality, on design, on keeping up with the competition. And Topps was able to do that when some brands in 1993 just couldn't do it. And of course, Topps throughout time with the eventual attrition of brands throughout the baseball card industry, Topps would emerge as the winner. You know, they survived. Of course, they had a long history before then. They had a great relationship with players and the Players Association and Major League Baseball well before that. But as these car companies started dying in the late 90s and early 2000s, Topps would turn out to be pretty much the lone victor in the end, in that it is the only approved Major League Baseball card for both Major League Baseball and for the Players Association. Now, that doesn't mean it's the only brand. It's the only company. Of course, Topps has the rights to a lot of brands under the umbrella, including Bowman for one, and there's plenty of others. You know, they've got a stadium club now. You've got Select. You've got so many different subsets that Topps rather nicely unrolls without completely flooding the market like it did back in the day. So, again, in 1993, while the hobby is bloating, while some brands are starting to die off, Topps was able to continue to evolve and put out a very nice card that, like I said, kept up with the competition, but also stayed contemporary. Now, some of the things that made 93 Topps a winner then and still makes it popular now, you had the Black Gold series, which was a series of insert cards, very nice insert cards. I still have a couple of them. And you could also win an insert card that was a redemption card. So you win the redemption card, you'd mail it in, and you would get a set of, I want to say it was 12 Black Gold cards. And I think there were three sets of 12. I may be off on some of those numbers. But anyways, you know, depending on the type of redemption cards, you could eventually accumulate an entire set through mail order. And you also had the very popular Topps Gold set. And Topps Gold was something that they started in 1992. It was immensely popular, and it was popular because not only was it a random gold card thrown into every few packs, but also you could win through the scratch-off game, you could win the mail-order cards, and those were not only gold, but they were branded winner. So, you know, here we go again with the parallels to the parallel cards. But in 1993, Topps took the gold concept and put a gold card in every pack. Now, you would think on the surface, that is just overkill. That's just too much gold. That's just too much of a good thing. That's going to, you know, kind of devalue the gold brand, if you will, or devalue the set. That has not been the case. In fact, that is one of the big reasons, along with the Derek Jeter rookie card, as to why 93 Tops is still very popular. It's not just design, it's not just inserts, but there is still value. In fact, I was surprised when I went looking around, and again, this is just a random internet search. If you go to garage sales or, you know, a hobby shop and a guy's got five cases of these, I'm sure he can give you a little bit of a discount on them. But I was kind of surprised to see Series 1 and Series 2 from the 93 Top set. Random searches here show me hobby boxes going anywhere from $20 to $30, sometimes $35 a box. Now, again, that $35 may be on the upper scale, and it may be somebody trying to rip you off. But in 1993, you had some card sets that were selling boxes at $12 or $14, some that I can't explain, like Leaf Studio and Fleer Ultra. But Topps is still very popular. It still pulls in a collector, and I think it's mostly because of the gold card. Much like I was talking about earlier with the Rediscover Topps, where there's a little bit of intrigue, hey, this pack may have this special insert card. Well, 93 Topps, you had that intrigue with every set. Okay, I'm going to get a gold card, but who is it going to be? And with an 825 card set, if you were lucky, your gold card was a hot rookie like Derek Jeter or a Mike Piazza or a Chipper Jones, or maybe it's a young star, you know, maybe it's a Ken Griffey Jr., you know, somebody along those lines, a major veteran, you know, Nolan Ryan or Cal Ripken Jr., or as it would turn out over time, an emerging star like Pedro Martinez, or you got Ron Karkovice. Nothing wrong with that, but, you know, there was still that intrigue. Hey, I can get a gold something out of this. And I think that's something that still keeps collectors coming back to the set, because you know you're going to get a gold card in every pack, but you have no idea what will be that gold card. Will it be a common card, or will it be a rookie card or a star card? Now, I do want to caution you, even though there's still some value on the retail side of this, there's still plenty of product out there. So, for example, when I was looking for pictures of 93 Topps cards, and often that leads to, you know, an eBay listing of a lot of cards. You know, there are people who have 50 Derek Jeter cards, and they'll sell them to you for $30 for the whole thing. So there's still a little oversaturation. There's still a little too much product that's out there. But much like Fleer Ultra, much like Leaf Studio, much like Upper Deck, again, if you have $20-$30 or so, and you want to put together a really nice set, then this is a set that you want to put together. This is really nice. It's certainly not going to hurt you if you go out and buy a box or two and kill a couple hours on a rainy or snowy day, depending on where you're listening, and open up the packs, see what you get. I can guarantee you, you'll get 36 gold cards. I just don't know whether they're going to be good players or common players. But again, just that really neat anticipation of getting that gold card coming back to you is a fun reason to open up these older cards all these years later. All right, our random pull, Pedro Martinez. And again, you know his career numbers, 219 wins to 100 losses, 2.93 earned run average, 3,154 strikeouts, 8-time All-Star, 3-time Cy Young Award winner, was also an All-Star Game MVP back in 1999. The Red Sox have already retired his number 45. He won a World Series with the Red Sox in 2004, ending that ridiculously long drought with that victory then. Prior to that, you know, you had to go back to 1918 for a Red Sox World Series victory. And, of course, very much loved in New England in particular, not only because he helped the Red Sox win that World Series, but he also made the Yankees look bad. And that is a very big thing in New England. But again, the funny thing, and I'm not going to go year by year through his career. I mean, we all know that Pedro Martinez, even though he didn't hit 300 wins, like I said, 3 Cy Young Awards, 3,000 plus strikeouts, he was definitely worthy of the Hall of Fame. And of course, playing in the Northeast, not just in Boston, but also with the New York Mets for a few years, you're going to get that East Coast push. And yes, there is an East Coast push with all these writers who are voting for players. But I'm not going to argue that he wasn't worthy of it. I absolutely think he was worthy of it. And when you get 91.1% of the vote on your first ballot, clearly quite a few people feel the same way. But the funny thing about Pedro Martinez is this guy, when he was signed by the Dodgers back in 1988, he was not very highly thought of. And he's a great story because he came out of a dirt poor town in the Dominican Republic. And it wasn't just, Ramon Martinez, his brother, who would be a standout player, but he also had other siblings who were involved in baseball, too. So baseball thrived in the family. And of course, when you're growing up in a dirt poor village in the Dominican Republic, you tend to strive a little harder to hone your craft so that you can get the hell out of there and make it big in the United States. For players in that situation who even get just a sniff at the major leagues, that's a big deal. But when you're somebody like Pedro and, of course, Ramon, like I said, Ramon Martinez was in the major leagues for quite a while and made quite a bit of coin and quite a bit of an impact as well. But when you're somebody like Pedro who can, sustain a very, very long career. How long was he in? 16, 17 years, win a World Series, all those trophies, get into the Hall of Fame. You've certainly done well for yourself. Now, as I mentioned, he was signed as a free agent by the Dodgers in 1988. Now, it's not like he was just roaming around, ballparks looking for a gig. As the situation was back then and is with other teams, a way to get around the draft is to set up these international scouting camps, if you will, training camps overseas, mostly in the Caribbean. And the Dodgers, of course, were well ahead of the curve with that. So they had a farm set up in the Dominican Republic, and they're bringing in all these quality players here. Well, Ramon Martinez was the one that the Dodgers really fell in love with, first of all, and they did sign him as a free agent back in 1984. So Ramon Martinez, I wouldn't say fast track, took him a few years, but he makes his major league debut in 1988 at the age of 20. And as I mentioned, Ramon, he was an all-star, had a 20-win season in 1990, had a pretty good career throughout the 90s, threw a no-hitter back in 1995. So again, in 1993, if I gave you the choice of a Ramon Martinez rookie card and a Pedro Martinez rookie card, 9 times out of 10, you would have taken the Ramon Martinez because he was already established. Granted, he wasn't doing as well in 92 and 93 as he was in 90 and 91. But with Ramon Martinez, you knew what you were getting. With Pedro Martinez, you didn't know what you were getting. And that was the problem for the Dodgers. They always thought that Pedro was too small. He was too skinny. He didn't really fit the profile of a major league pitcher, or at least a dominant major league pitcher. There's all sorts of stories that Tommy Lasorda, then the manager of the Dodgers, didn't really care for him. He was going to use him more in the bullpen as opposed to a starter. This, despite the fact that ever since as a teenager, Pedro was turning heads back in his hometown, and even Ramon Martinez would say Pedro's the better pitcher. But, everyone in the Dodgers organization still kept their focus on Ramon, while Pedro was just kind of drifting around first in the Dodgers minor league system and then eventually by 1992 with the big club. So despite going 10-5 with a 2.61 earned run average in 1993, the Dodgers that November decide to move on, trading him to Montreal for Delino DeShields. Now, Delino DeShields was a much-touted infielder back in the early 90s and was part of this surging Expos team. And I'm going to make a similar argument now to Pedro for Delino as I did for Nolan Ryan and a few other players for Jim Fregosi, that infamous trade that the Mets pulled off of the Angels back in 1971. If you haven't listened to our 93 Fleer Ultra podcast with Nolan Ryan, listen to that argument, because even though hindsight being 2020, the Mets were absolutely fleeced in that deal, at the time, it wasn't a bad trade. And I will have to say the same for the Dodgers in November of 1993. They had a second baseman. His name was Jody Reed. And Reed was in a very bitter contract holdout and contract negotiations with the Dodgers. So they want to upgrade second base now. They're going to show Jody Reed who's the boss, and they're going to just go out and acquire a young and up-and-coming second baseman. So the Expos, who, as we would later find out, were going to be in no position to actually maintain a winning team for a long time. Well, they had Delino DeShields, and DeShields had spent a few seasons with the Expos. He was the runner-up for the National League Rookie of the Year in 1990, had some pretty good years in 92 and 93. So it looks like Delino DeShields is on the way up. The Dodgers were never sold on Pedro Martinez. After all, they had their brother Ramon, who was showing signs of life once again. So on the surface, it makes sense. All right, a one for one. I'll give you this pitcher that we're not really sure of, and we'll take this second baseman who seems to be on the upswing. Well, of course, that deal didn't exactly work out, as DeShields would only play a few seasons. In fact, I think three seasons with the Dodgers, was never able to get to the standout level that people thought he would, even though he did have good seasons in 92 and 93. He just didn't turn out to be the star second baseman that the Dodgers hoped for. And just, you know, practically overnight, Pedro Martinez goes to Montreal and becomes a star. In his first season, 1994, the strike-shortened season, 11-5 with a 3.42 earned run average. And for a frankly mediocre Expos team, Pedro excelled. In fact, in 1997, year where he won his first Cy Young Award, 17-8 with a 1.90 earned run average. Again, this was for a pretty average Montreal Expos team, and Pedro absolutely dominated. Well, if you thought by 1994 the Expos weren't going to be able to consistently put together a good team by 1997, it was pretty obvious. And I remember there was a practically a nightly watch on where Pedro was going to go. And I remember in the 97 season, I got a chance to see Pedro pitch when he was with Montreal in Atlanta. At least I think I saw Pedro pitch, because these were in the $5 general admission seats that were roughly a mile and a half from home plate. Yeah, I was pretty much in Macon, Georgia, you know, masquerading as Turner Field, watching this little speck on the pitcher's mound that looked like Pedro Martinez. No, I think it was actually him. Well, he wasn't traded during the season, but shortly thereafter, he was traded to the Boston Red Sox for Tony Armas Jr. Tony was, by the way, the player to be named later, and Carl Pavano. Of course, we know where Carl Pavano ended up, going to the Florida Marlins, winning a World Series with them later on down the line. But the Boston Red Sox hit pay dirt with Pedro Martinez, and of course, the rest is history. He would pick up his other two Cy Young Awards. From there, he would become a legend in Boston, not only because he was an outstanding pitcher, but he just had this oversized personality. Some people would call it annoying, but a lot of people just absolutely loved him. And even though he was part of the 2004 World Championship team, he actually statistically had one of his worst seasons, certainly in terms of earned run average. His highest earned run average came in 2004. He had a 16-9 record. And he did, however, still pound the fastballs in the zone there, 227 strikeouts that year. But again, the overall message was he was a big, big part of that rotation and of the Red Sox finally winning a World Series. And he had a pretty good postseason, except for the ALCS. He did not do very well against the Yankees, but otherwise had a pretty memorable postseason run against the Angels and Cardinals that year. Now, the Red Sox, up to the idea that As lovable as Pedro was at the age of 33, he was going to go downhill. They let him walk. He signs a pretty monstrous deal with the New York Mets going into the 2005 season. In fact, how much was he getting paid back then? Well, it was actually a pretty decent amount. It averaged out to about $13 million a season, but still an awful lot to give an aging pitcher, and his numbers would slip a little here and there. He had a pretty good 2005 season. But as time went on, eventually, wasn't able to live up to the hype. Would finish his career in 2009 with the Phillies, making another World Series appearance, and again, not looking so sharp against the Yankees. In fact, he got shelled in a couple of games in that World Series, which the Yankees won. But Pedro would call it a career shortly thereafter. As I mentioned, a Hall of Famer, no doubt about that. And, of course, if you're a baseball fan, you know what he's been up to ever since then. He's been working on the MLB Network, and that is where his personality comes out. But he is also a very, very knowledgeable analyst, and I enjoy watching him on TV. I can't say that about every former athlete who makes his way into broadcasting. Some athletes get it. They know how to do it. Others, not so much. I think Pedro is really, really good at what he does. And had the Dodgers thought the same thing 25 years ago, who knows? Maybe the Dodgers have some World Series titles. Maybe he goes into the Hall of Fame with that Dodger cap on. But that's not the case, as he is more known for his time in Boston, certainly, in Montreal as well. In fact, you could argue he was the last great pitcher in Montreal Expos history. And he was pretty dominant on the mound back then, even though the Dodgers had no idea that he would turn out this way, because they were looking a little too much at his brother Ramon as to the gifts and the talent that Pedro had right in their own backyard. All right, so that is our look at the career of Pedro Martinez, the somewhat surprising career if you're traveling back to 1993. Also, card number 557, our random pull from that set. All right, that does it for the Monster Box, believe it or not. So we're going to be moving on from the Monster Box to those special podcasts about minor league cards, team-issued sets, and the logo-less cards. And then we'll travel back in time to the 1950s and do it all over again, from the big old Monster Box to the big old binder. So if you have any comments about 93 Tops or Pedro Martinez, do so at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. And make sure you join us Friday via Audio Boom or iTunes for our look at the minor league cards. We'll go scrounging around the collection, see what we can pull together, and just talk minor league baseball cards a little bit on Friday. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.